Advance tickets are available now for $20 through Eventbrite or by emailing me at ganspringrock@gmail.com. You can also help by buying one of our incredible Ganrocks 2026 t-shirts and participating in our fundraising auction on Facebook featuring wonderful gifts from local businesses, all in support of a great cause. So take a look on Facebook for Ganrocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
Good morning and welcome to Finding Your Way Home, Real Talk on Real Estate. I am your host, Sherry Doherty, and I have the pleasure of being with you every Monday morning at 10 a.m. Today, I have a special guest in the studio with me. I have Kieran Doherty, and yes, he is my son. However, he has been invited to come in today and bring us a different perspective about housing. He is 27, so bringing us the under 30 mindset. He also has had the benefit, I guess I'll call it, of being exposed to me in my real estate career for the last 7 years. He also does work for me, and he's also currently working for the mortgage professionals. He also has his own personal experience. He tried to purchase a condo a couple of years ago and learned a lot in that condo experience. So I wanted to pick his brain a little bit about what he and people his age are thinking about housing these days. So welcome to the show, Kieran.
Thank you for having me on. Can you turn me up a little bit?
Sure. I sure can. Yeah. Can you not hear yourself?
Not really. Okay. Yeah, I can hear myself now. Okay. Amazing. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I want to hear your own thoughts.
Yeah, a little.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you for that. That's what you get for having your child on. He'll tell you when he can't hear himself.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's jump right in and talk about your experience buying the condo. That's always an interesting one. And do you want to tell us where you were, why you were doing that, and what happened?
I ask myself that all the time, to be honest. I went to Queens for 5 years, and in my final year at Queens, I decided that I maybe didn't want to go there anymore, but I still obviously had to finish school because I wanted to make sure that I finished my education on time. And in the middle of all that, I decided, which I don't know if anyone's ever decided this before, but that I was going to move to Edmonton while still attending the school.
And that's a very interesting decision.
Yeah. Didn't tell my teachers or anything like that. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make this work and we'll try and figure this out. But I ended up getting a job in the oil and gas industry working on a drilling rig.
Okay.
Because I don't need to tell anybody here that, but oil riggers make a lot of money.
Yes, that's correct.
That's what it is.
That would be a way to make money for a down payment for a home. Yes.
And also, it's not like I felt like I needed to do this. It's something that I actually just genuinely wanted to do. It wasn't like there was no jobs in Ontario where I couldn't have got somewhere to work closer. This was just something that I was also interested in at the time. And I figured, okay, well, if I'm not going to work in the film industry, which is currently being determined right now, when I'm done school, might as well try my hand in something that I've actually been interested in for the past. And I ended up applying for like 100 or so jobs and then eventually getting one and then moving to Edmonton a month before my first semester of school started. And then long story short, like literally flew back and forth every 2 weeks to go to class. And I would work 15 days on the rigs and 6 days off. And in those 6 days off, I would take a red eye flight back to Toronto or Ottawa or have you or dad or Sam Marie or somebody else pick me up from the airport just so I could go to like 3 or 4 days of classes, try and make up for what I can of lost time, catch up with my friends, go do my things, and then literally fly right back. And while I was there, I learned a lot about the home market because the cost of living in Alberta, just point blank, is cheaper than it is in Ontario.
Okay.
Like, I don't need nobody.
Well, your sister lives in Saskatchewan, and we could talk about that one day, but definitely they could purchase a single family home in Saskatchewan at a much more reasonable price than they could have in Ontario.
Yes. And so I was making more money than I had ever made before. And also I was spending less money on living than I had ever made or than I had ever had to, just because rent is cheaper, food is cheaper. It just is what it is out there, which is why part of the reason I wanted to move out there in the first place was what it was. And with that as well, too, is like the housing market is just significantly cheaper than what it is. Just to be clear, I'm not telling anybody that you have to move to Edmonton or Alberta in general in order to be able to buy a house, but like that was my experience. And so you and I started to look out there just online in terms of like what was available and came across the idea of like wanting to purchase a condo in an area that would allow me to get to work still.
Well, they're very reasonably priced.
They are very reasonably priced.
Like shocking.
Yeah, to the point where I was like, well, what's wrong with these places? But
odds are, we found out.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes. But also, that was a pretty isolated incident. If I wanted to buy another condo after, I probably could have. Excuse me. It wouldn't have been an issue. Now, basically, we figured out that, like, the average condo there was, like, anywhere between, like, $70,000 for like an okay one, all the way up to like 100 to 180 to 200, and then any like nice, like very nice, what most people would consider nice condo is like $200,000, which like you couldn't get that for something.
I think it was actually less than that.
I'm just saying, like, if you wanted to get a really nice one,
a really nice high end one, but we were looking at some. I think they were like 120.
Yeah, and so I was like, maybe I will buy one of these. Like, this seems like it's relatively reasonable, and I had the money in terms of like a down payment to be able to do it. And obviously, it ended up going awry, but not because of anything beyond it, my control.
Well, and everything happens for a reason, because you're not there anymore.
I am not there anymore.
I'm happy we're not trying to sell a condo.
If I ended up owning this condo, I'd probably still be there paying it.
Fair, you would be.
But yeah, in a nutshell, like, we went through the entire process of going to look at a bunch of homes. And as you know, and as our realtor out there knows, I wasn't very picky. I was like, well, if it has running water and heat, we're good. And he's like, no, you want it. Like, do you like these type of windows? Do you like this area? And I was like, it's fine. Like, I didn't really care.
You didn't care.
And we came across one that actually worked, in my opinion, for me, which was like basically just a giant shoebox downtown on like the fifth floor of a building near where the Edmonton Oilers play.
Okay.
Near a bunch of bars, like, great desirable area that you want to be in.
A grocery store close by you could walk to, and places you could go meet girls.
Yeah, restaurants, bars, like all sorts of stuff within a 5-minute walk.
Anyone, someone 25 would want.
Yeah, exactly. And so my thought was, I'll live there for a couple of years and pay that condo off slowly over time. And then 3 or 4 years from then, even if I were just making the minimum, you know, payments that I would need as my mortgage, over time, within 3 or 4 years, by the time I turn 30, it'll be paid off and maybe I'll go buy another one.
Right.
That was my exact thought. Do you have anything you want to say before I move forward?
Well, what happened? So you didn't purchase that condo, but what did you learn? So we actually successfully made an offer.
Yeah, we made the offer and it then got approved. And then I was fired up. I remember where I was. I was at like the rec center at the time, at like our version of the YMCA, in like a neighborhood that I lived with a guy that we know with for a bit. And I ended up like getting the email being like, yeah, like you've been approved. And I was like, no way, this is insane. Like, I'm actually going to, I remember like jumping up and down being like, I'm going to be a homeowner. This is crazy.
Okay, I'm going to give you the words, because you're missing the specific real estate words.
Sure.
So you had a conditionally accepted offer.
Sure.
So you and the seller came to an agreement on a purchase price.
Yes.
Fortunately, you have a really great realtor in me, and you had a great realtor in Edmonton.
Yes.
And we put conditions in.
There were conditions. Offer. Yes.
And so obviously one was financing, because we never let anybody buy anything without a condition of financing, even if you're pre-approved. We can talk about that another time.
These are all words I would not know.
That's why I'm giving you the words. And then, do you remember what the other condition was?
No.
You do. You just don't have the words right now. The other
home inspection?
No.
No.
It was review of the condo documents.
That to me, that's like a home inspection.
Nope,
obviously, it's not.
Literally not a home inspection.
Any realtor listening to this right now is going, this kid's dumb. He's not.
No, it is not a home inspection. It is a review of the condominium documents. So from a layperson's perspective,
it's kind of like a home inspection of documents.
Sure. It's an inspection of documents.
Yeah. And we reviewed the condo documents.
Well, your lawyer did.
I didn't. My lawyer did. And then called you, and then called me, and then called our realtor and said, you should not live here. And I was like, whoa, I really want to live here. Long story short, the actual unit was fine, but the underground parking structure that the unit was on top of and all the other units, I think there was probably 80 or 90 units in the building. It was like a 6 or 7 story building. And basically, there was a condo assessment that was coming up that was like $6.5 million.
Special assessment.
Special assessment.
Close.
Sure,
good.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And they only had like $280,000 in like the reserves, meaning that every single person who lived there, on top of just paying what they were going to have to pay, was going to have to pay like $250,000 out of pocket.
That's
in order to pay for the repair of the sinking or destroyed parking structure, in which everybody was like, you can't live here. And I was like, but it's near the bars that I want to go to. Like, that was my thought in my head.
I know that was your thought.
But like, I don't, like, this is where I want to live. This is everything for me. So it was difficult to walk away from it and go, hey, I can't live here, because I really wanted to. And it was really cool for 4 or 5 days where I thought I was going to be able to live downtown and be like a cool bachelor in Edmonton. And then that ended up not happening.
Okay. The most important point of that is that essentially, well, here's what happened. I know that Lacon and I, so Lacon was this fantastic realtor in Edmonton. Ever going there.
He's the guy.
He was great. But we were both pretty concerned right at the onset that, let's say there was, I'm going to use example numbers, say there were 150 units in this building, 75 were for sale.
Yeah.
We kept wondering why are so many for sale, and they were really reasonably priced. And you know, law of supply and demand, the more that are available, the price goes down. There didn't seem to be that much supply. So we already kind of had our spidey sense up that something might be funky in the financial setup.
Optimistically being like, well, maybe this is just a,
maybe it's just
a fluke.
But it was not. And the reason was that no one of the current owners wanted to pay that upcoming special assessment for the new parking garage.
$250,000 a person.
Right, 100%. So that is a red flag for our listeners. If you're ever considering a condominium building and there are many units available in the condo building, it can very well be a red flag that there is something up in the health of the financials of the condo corporation.
Yeah.
And therefore, we did not let you firm up on that purchase.
Yeah.
And you were sad.
I was sad for a bit. And then I realized, you know what? I have other things that I need to take care of that were not like finishing school. And I realized that oil rigging in the summer is really cool. But oil rigging in the winter is about as not cool as you could possibly get.
It's as cool as it can possibly literally. Get temperature-wise.
There were a couple of days where it was like minus 35, minus 40 in like late November, early December. And I remember saying to the people that I worked with that had worked at the company that I worked at for 20 years, and they were just like, this isn't even as bad as it gets.
Right.
And I kept saying to them, how does it get any worse than this? Like, well, you could not feel your fingers. And I'd say, well, I can't feel my fingers. I didn't even want me to say. And they're like, it doesn't matter. Even if it's minus 55 or 60, people still need gas at the pumps every day, no matter where you are. Mm-hmm. And we have to go get that gas for them.
That's right. And that was why you got paid so much money.
Yes. And that's the thing, right? Is like, no one would do the job if it paid minimum wage.
Right. 100%. And that's why they pay so much, because it's very unpleasant and dangerous.
Yes. And so I did it for 5.5 months, and I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about the housing market out there. Maybe at a later date I would own a home in Edmonton, because like the market is still actually quite good. Mm-hmm. And I probably could have bought another condo if I wanted to, but I kind of took that as a sign to go, hey, you're not financially responsible for anything here. And the guy I was living with was very casual about me just like leaving when I wanted to.
Right.
So I was like, all right, cool. I, in theory, could pack up all of my stuff into my one car and drive back through the US into Ontario.
And you did.
And I did.
Okay. So here we are now back in Ontario.
Yes.
And
a year later.
Where do you live?
In your basement.
Right. And why do you live in my basement?
That's a much deeper story that I don't think we have.
Basically,
it's
cost effective.
Yeah. It's cheaper than rent, and it makes more sense right now if you were ever trying to buy a home. Obviously, there's caveats to that, because not every single person can live with their parents.
Of course.
While I was finishing my time at school, it made no sense for me to go rent a unit downtown Kingston like I was in the university district 2 or 3 years before that.
So you did do that. You lived in several different locations.
I lived in three different homes. Right. I lived in one beside the Arc, which is like at the corner of University and Earl. I lived on Aberdeen for a year, and then I lived on Cooper Street.
Okay. And I do remember you saying you were over it. Like, that was a great university experience, and living with a bunch of guys is fun, but it's gross.
Yeah.
And you wanted actually vegetables in your fridge and a clean bathroom.
Well, the dishes.
And you wanted to save money.
It doesn't matter who's listening to this. If you live in a house with people in the university district, there are arguments probably every week about who's doing the dishes and who's not doing them.
Right.
Okay. That is a universal thing, no matter who you are, who you live with. That is just a thing if you don't live by yourself.
Okay. So you have the benefit of having family in Kingston, but your friends that are still in school.
Yes. I used to think that it was like a curse, because I was like, well, I have to have family stuff going on while I'm also in school. But I also, during COVID, used that as a way to like come hang out with you guys and do those things that my friends didn't have the privilege of.
Right. Okay. And so where do most of your friends live now?
Like in the university district, within like a 5-minute walk from here. I parked in front of their house.
Okay. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. And I know I talked about this last week with Ayush, but what are you hearing about what average rent is for a room for a student?
Much more than it ever was even 3 or 4 years ago.
He quoted us $1,200 a room.
So when I lived on, this is actually insane. I don't even think this is a thing anymore. But in 2020, going into the fall, was when I had my first year at Queens. And a unit that I lived in was 600, and it was in the most desirable area, literally beside the Arc at the corner of University and Earl, right on campus. I had a unit that was $635 a month with utilities, Wi-Fi, and parking included.
Wow.
And I got really lucky, but I ended up giving up that house to go for somewhere a little bit cheaper because I thought living on Aberdeen Street would make me like cool. And it ended up not.
We're
it was
not
just a lot
that.
Of stress and liability. And everybody wants to use your house for their washroom on St. Patrick's Day and homecoming. And I was like, this is going to be the greatest thing. And it ended up just being a giant pain the entire time. So I moved off the street with a bunch of friends.
Okay.
And we moved into a 9-bedroom house. And even that, which is crazy, was... we paid $675 a month to live at that, which was in 2022 and 2023. And then we actually ended up getting evicted from that house because they wanted to renovate it.
Okay.
And they literally, and we know the people who moved in right after this, and they literally just renovated the floors mm-hmm. and then jacked up the rent to, I think it was $1,100 a month.
Okay.
So almost more than double. We were the last like really cheap place to live, before like the rent just went out of control. So that was interesting. That was, you know, 2 to 3 years ago at this point. And now the cost of rent is, if you want anywhere that's like south of Princess Street near the university, like within a 5 to 10 minute walk, you're looking at $1,000 a month or more without utilities, Wi-Fi, or parking.
Yep, that's what I'm hearing.
It's
that's
crazy.
Amazing. So you and your friends are either graduated or in the process of being in last year, I think most of your friends.
Yep.
What are people your age talking about where they go next? Do they have aspirations to purchase a home, or are they thinking they're going to go back to their parents and save money for a couple of years, or do they think they're going to go wherever they're going to go and rent? What's kind of the discussion, or are they even talking about it?
Well, most of my friends, it kind of depends on like where they're from proximity wise. So we'll say like 20 of my friends, for the most part, I'd say 18 of them are from Toronto or the GTA, and then the other two are from the US.
Okay.
And the ones that are from Toronto have no intention of buying a home probably in the next 3 to 4 years, or maybe even after that as well too, because why would you not just go, what even if they were going to work a job in Toronto, why would you not just stay at home with your parents and save all that money for 4 or 5 years from the time you're 21 to, we'll say, 26 or 27?
Yep.
And then maybe purchase a home after that. Obviously, there's caveats to every single person's personal experience with their family, but I would say 80 to 90% of people that I've spoken to in my friend group and other ones are like, hey, when I graduate, I'm going to move back in for a couple of years, see what happens with the job market, the housing market, and then also try and figure out the plan from there. But it makes no sense to try and purchase a home now, especially in the GTA, because obviously the cost of living in Toronto is much higher.
Right, 100%.
As for the people in the United States, they can purchase a home pretty much whenever they want.
Sure.
Like the people, well, that is true. Like I know three people who graduated from Queens back in 2023 that are all either 25 or a little bit younger, and all of them own homes now.
Really?
Yes.
And is that because just the cost of housing is so much cheaper in the US?
It's cheaper, but also like I was thinking about it on the way here, like proximity wise, like the 85% of Canada's population lives in the bottom 5% of the landmass.
Yep.
Whereas in the United States, it's entirely spread out. So they have a lot more space to like work with. Like not many people are going to live in the Northwest Territories unless they're from there. But there's people that live in every state in the US. Obviously population density, certain people live in different areas more, but at the same time, there's just a lot of people that like have the ability to like buy a home there because the cost of living is just cheaper. And it's part of people's like idea of what they want. Whereas all of my friends who are from Canada are like, we're not going to own a home probably until our late 20s or early 30s.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I know I've mentioned this before, but, you know, I graduated college. Dad and I got together. We saved, I don't know, $5,000. And that was our first down payment on a house.
Yeah.
And it was just understood that, you know, once you were kind of on the path to being established, you would buy a house and you would get married and have children and do all the things.
Yeah.
And I know that that's for sure at least delayed for at least 10 years.
Yeah, if you were going to do that, we'll say at 25, probably 35 or 33 is like when most people, I would say, are thinking about it now.
Yeah, the statistic is that there used to be average first-time home buyer was in their 20s.
Yeah.
And I've heard it now as late 40s, because it is difficult. You and I were talking about this off air as well, but a huge percentage, I think it might be close to 80, only get into their first home because of a gift.
Well, so I'm thinking about it two ways now. You either have parents that like have the ability to give you a down payment.
Yep.
Or eventually, say you're in your 40s and 50s, at some point your parents would pass away just based on age.
Yep.
And then obviously you would inherit that, assuming that was what it would be. Those would probably be my two most realistic ideas of how people would eventually acquire a house unless they came into like some insane source of money.
Yeah. It's very difficult, especially if you're living on your own, to pay rent, have a car, eat, pay your utilities, pay your car insurance, and try and put some away to then build a nest egg for your own down payment.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
The cost of living is just too great now for that to then be a priority.
Well, I know you've done this, but the spread on how quickly costs have risen versus cost of housing is incrementally 5 or 6 or 10 times higher, as well as the increase in wages hasn't kept pace.
Not at all.
Not even one little bit.
Not one bit. It is harder now than it's ever been to purchase a home compared to what it was in the 70s, 80s, or 90s. Like, same thing. Like, one of my childhood best friends there, you know them, Chris, obviously. Mm-hmm. His parents bought their first home for like $140,000 in our neighborhood in Barrie back in 1999. And they sold it for $1.8 million without making any renovations to it whatsoever during the height of like the COVID like real estate boom in 2021.
Yeah.
And then they moved to Nova Scotia with $1 million in their pocket.
That was very smart on their part.
Yeah, it was.
Very smart on that part.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's not a thing right now, obviously.
Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit, while you are pursuing your long-term career goals, you are also doing a lot of, I'm going to call it freelance work, and you're currently working at the Mortgage Professionals.
I am.
So not only are you spending all of your time in my world listening to me talk about what I do, as well as doing work for me, you're also doing work for the Mortgage Professionals.
I am.
So you're getting a lot of exposure to language of housing or financing housing, mortgages, and all of those sorts of things. I wanted to pick your brain a little bit about what you're hearing. Or actually, let's go this way. What you have found most interesting that you've been hearing about that either the housing market or how you ultimately finance a house?
Most interesting. I mean, I hear about interest rates every single day. That's like
you
what
do,
the majority
yes.
of I hear. And just like how it works. I'd say the most interesting thing is that like the people think that like politicians, for example, have any impact on like what goes on with like interest rates, and that's just not true at all. It's the Bank of Canada and like the federal government, obviously.
Yep.
And they don't really control that. So that's one thing that like I didn't know until or couldn't rationalize in my head until as of recent. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who the prime minister or president is, like they don't control the overnight rate for interest.
Yeah, the way, so Karen Mathey is the person and she's been a guest on our show, but the way she describes it is so easy to understand that it made it crystal clear for me as well.
Okay.
Which is fantastic because ultimately, let's say 10 years ago, I didn't understand it as well either, but you're absolutely right. The Bank of Canada sets those rates. Not your local politician.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'd say the most interesting thing to me is just that like there's a lot of things that it's kind of, I mean, same thing with like your GPA is kind of like your credit rating, but with like the banks.
Okay.
And stuff like that. Like if I
was wondering where you were going with that.
There are so many ways that you can destroy your credit rating or GPA.
Mm-hmm.
Like it can go down quite a bit, mm-hmm. but there's very incremental ways that you can increase it to make it go up if you've already destroyed it over time.
Yeah. 100%.
That's kind of what it is. Like if you get one bad grade on an assignment, that's going to tank your GPA. Same thing with, excuse me, if you make one insane financial decision, that might tank your credit rating and it's going to take you.
Oh, it can take a very long time to recover. Which is interesting. And what about the time that you've spent either, you know, watching me grow my real estate business or hearing me interact with my clients? What do you hear me say over and over again that's stuck? Or what do you just think you hear me say over and over again that's interesting?
Just that people have to be like organized and also like realistic about what they can get for homes. And I mean, I think a lot of people in the age of like watching like the Property Brothers and HGTV believe that they have like a lot of knowledge of how things are based on like their friends or somebody else that might've got something, not understanding that like the market shifts every single day or every month or every year. And what you might've seen a year ago, and that was your expectation of what you might get for your home or be able to purchase for it, is just not what it might be now based on a number of different things. Like things change all the time.
Oh, literally. I tell people that a market evaluation is as good as today.
Yeah.
And that's it. And even if we're talking about putting your home on the market and we're getting ready, I have to pull data so we have a general idea what your home is going to be worth right now. But say it's 2 weeks from now after we've done a pre-inspection and photography and staged it and gotten fully ready to go to market, I have to re-pull the data because one neighbor's house that sold across the street could change what you were thinking about going to market with, or four more coming on the market, again, talking about law of supply and demand, could change what you can go to market with. So it's very, very real time. I also, it's interesting that you bring up what, you know, people are seeing on TV because real estate is glamorized on TV.
Definitely.
And it is not at all. People don't realize, and I know I've made jokes about this, but, you know, we all watched Owning Manhattan, and I don't run around showing houses in short skirts and high heels and going to the bars all night and doing fancy dances to sell our houses. More reality is that I'm out in my snow boots and I am watching a septic tank get pumped, which is the worst smell ever, just for the record.
Yeah, there's a lot of, this is what I will say, is it's not as like, yeah, for getting a deal and like, it's great. And you watch those shows where people are like, I got a $2 million commission.
Right.
I've watched you do not a lot of glamorous things in some weird, you know, parts of Ontario where you have to go and
or into
show
some
a home.
Really yeah. questionable houses.
Yeah, exactly. Where there's like, it feels like there's a floor in the, like there's just a hole in the floor.
Oh,
and
yeah.
different things where you walk in and be like, this is just a, why would anyone want to live here?
Right.
But you have to show the home if someone wants to see it.
Right. Well, you know, I will tell the story recently, and for anybody listening, I typically don't go and meet someone for the very first time on my own for safety reasons. I'm a woman in real estate, and so I either have my partner come with me or my husband or even Kieran or a friend will come with me sometimes for a first meeting. And there was one that I had planned to go to on my own recently, and just I don't know. My husband talked me out of it and said, please take Kieran with you. You haven't been up there before. It was a little bit remote and he really wanted me to take you.
It was like an hour and a half in the winter, like
it
each
was,
way.
Yeah. And you are an incredible documentarian and you do a lot of my film work, my property tours. So it's great to have you with me. Anyways, you can just document my day and we can get some content, which is great.
Yeah.
And we went to this house and you said to me, I have a conference call that I need to jump on. So can I come out in the car and take this call once you're in and I know that you're okay. And I said, sure. I don't know if it's this man and his wife and three kids, or I don't know who he is. So let's just check him out together. And then if it's all good, I'll give you the green light. You can go out to the car and take your call. So we both went to the house. We met the man. We saw the house. We were both scared.
It looked like a horror movie set.
It did. Well, you actually said to him in a nice way, you should rent this house out for a horror movie set. And he said, I know, I've thought of it.
Yeah, he must have known. Like,
oh,
before
he knew,
that. It's crazy.
For sure, right?
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful. And then I looked at you and gave you the eyes that were, if you go out to this car, I will kill you because I might not come out of here.
It would have been so funny to be like, all right, bye, I'm leaving.
So we were in and out fairly quickly because it was not somewhere that I wanted to be. And you didn't even want to be there, but I was very, very grateful that you came with me.
Yeah, there were
so
like dolls on the wall from like the 90s.
So it was, yeah, there's sometimes they're fantastic and other times there's like dogs that I could be afraid of, let alone people.
Yeah.
So I sincerely appreciate that. But it is great to have you involved. And, you know, we've seen a ton of stuff. And I guess one of my final questions for you would be, you know, do you think that homeownership is in your future anywhere in the next 5 to 10 years? And I know your situation is unique because you're not 100% sure where you're going to be living.
Yeah.
But assume a straight line to, you know, 35. And what does that look like for you?
That's a loaded question. Yeah, I believe so, but I'm not as concerned about it as I used to be. I used to think like you need to own a home by this age and be married by this age. And then I realized now more over time that like, all those milestones that people kind of set for themselves or each other are like, they don't really matter as long as you are happy
right.
and are where you want to be. And like, you're moving on a path that's like works for you. And I have a very, very unique path, which we can talk about at a later date.
Different show, different time.
Yeah, not sure where I'm going to be 2 months from now in terms of living. And it's been very exciting. And so I'm probably not going to own a home for a couple more years. Just even if I were to come into millions of dollars right now, like I just wouldn't because it would make no sense to.
Right.
Because I just don't know where I'm going to be placed. But long term, over an extended period of time, I could definitely see myself owning a home somewhere.
Okay.
That like I'd love to actually call my home.
Okay, perfect. Before we say goodbye for today, I do have one thing that I want to chat with people about or mention to people. Last year, some colleagues and I put together a series of workshops called DIY Like a Girl. And these workshops are specifically designed for women in home ownership on their own. And there can be any number of reasons why women are in home ownership on their own. They could have worked their butts off and bought their own house. They could have been divorced. They could have been widowed. They could be two women living in the household together. There could be any number of reasons. And what we discovered was our fathers didn't teach us how to change the furnace filter or how to fix a leaky faucet. They were doing that with their sons. And we're very strong, independent women who need to know how to do those things. So we put on this series of workshops last year that was really well received. It was fantastic because I do them with Tammy Watson, who is the Canadian home the Canadian Handywoman, and Nancy Pike, who is owns Pike Inspections. Fantastic females in this industry that I work with on a regular basis. They're brilliant. And they had people holding a drill for the first time, showing them how to actually use a tape measure. They had them, you know, showing them the different kind of bits and doing caulking in live stations. So it was really interesting. It was really, really well received. This time we have some new material, and I'm actually going to be presenting the top 10 things that will kill your real estate transaction. So do you even know what's in your house and how to find out what those things are that are in your house? And that is all happening tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. If you look up the Facebook group or look it up on Eventbrite, you will find it. It is called DIY Like a Girl. And you can reach out to me directly, and obviously I can get you registered for that. So with that, I wanted to say thank you again, Karen, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Anytime.
It's always interesting to have the mindset of a different generation and hearing about whether or not you guys are hoping for or thinking of or able to finance your future homes. With that, I wish you and all of our listeners a very lovely day finding their way home.
Thank you.
I remember that week when the tapes that we got from KPF.
I miss my brother, how are my sisters doing? Toronto chewed me up and spit me out. Now I'm headed home for
I remember that week when the tapes that we got from KPFA's coverage came down to us, and I started to listen to them, and my jaw just dropped open because the people from the
Fruit Punch
were on the scene, and in some of the cases, some of them were probably getting beaten by police as they were trying to report on what was going on. It's just riveting, riveting sound.
What do you think of what's going on right now, sir?
I think they should burn down the whole place.
Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. U.S. Supreme Court strikes Colorado's conversion therapy ban, India's president erases trans rights, and the queer audio legacy of This Way Out's Greg Gordon. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 3rd, 2026.
The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Colorado law banning so-called conversion therapy for minors, opening the door to dismantling similar bans nationwide. Colorado was one of 23 states with laws prohibiting health practitioners from engaging in debunked methods to change a young person's gender identity and/or sexual orientation. The case was brought to federal courts by Kaylee Childs, a licensed counselor who argued the ban infringed on free speech and her right to talk with patients about her beliefs on what she calls biological sex. The court agreed, sending the case back to the lower court for further review. Out of the 9 judges, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was the lone dissenter, arguing that conversion therapy causes lasting psychological harm. Childs was represented by Alliance Defending Freedom, a notoriously anti-LGBTQ conservative Christian legal group. In their words, the ruling allows clinicians to confirm biological reality. Childs reacted to the news in an interview with Fox and Friends.
I am elated by the ruling, and I am very excited for the kids and their families who have been simply seeking options and counseling, and now they'll get to do so.
Kristen Wagner, president and CEO of ADF, says the ruling supports science.
The science tells us, actually, that 90% of kids that are allowed to grow through puberty, they'll be just fine.
But Josh Rovinger, the legal director of GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, says that simply is not true.
Every major U.S. medical association confirms that conversion therapy is both harmful and ineffective. Studies show it increases the risk of suicidality, depression, and anxiety.
Almost 700,000 adults in the U.S. have received conversion therapy at some point in their lives, according to the Williams Institute, an independent think tank researching gender identity and policy. Survivors are 88% more likely to attempt suicide than those who have not been subjected to the treatment. Rovinger says that while this ruling is a disappointment, there is still hope.
It does not mean that conversion therapists are free from consequences. Conversion therapists who harm patients can still face legal consequences, including under medical malpractice laws. This is a setback, but not an ending.
March 31st is International Transgender Day of Visibility, a day meant for trans joy and radical acceptance. But in India, the celebration of the contributions of transgender people was marked with rebellious protests as crowds rallied against the nation's regressive reform of trans rights. Despite appeals, President Draupadi Murmu approved the bill for assent on March 30th. Ironically called the Transgender Person's Protection of Rights, it essentially undoes a 2014 Supreme Court ruling that affirmed the fundamental rights of the country's nearly 400,000 transgender citizens under the Constitution. Human Rights Watch said the bill would put transgender people at risk and criminalize their existence by introducing legal punishments for coercing or alluring people to be transgender. It would also require medical screenings before a transgender person can receive gender-affirming care and legal recognition. Protesters told Telegraph India that this legislation was passed because people in power don't understand the transgender community.
There are very few medical professionals in this country who understand and recognize trans-affirmative healthcare.
Amnesty International India Chair Akar Patel called the policy a fundamental shift in how the state views transgender people that sets a dangerous precedent. Still, protesters and activists are not losing faith and plan to keep fighting.
Even if the government is against us, like, we can form our own safe spaces, our own spaces of support. As long as we have each other and we can find each other in various spaces, I think we can stand strong.
The White House observed Transgender Day of Visibility by denouncing former President Joe Biden's presidential proclamation recognizing the day in 2024. The press release mocked the observance, saying the era of government-sanctioned delusion is over, and that official policy that only recognizes, quote, two immutable sexes, male and female. Many states are challenging the Trump administration's gender policies, and the administration is slapping back with countersuits, the latest being against Minnesota's Department of Education and High School League. The claim is that the state is violating federal law with its trans-inclusive student-athlete policies. This comes just 1 week after the International Olympic Committee officially banned transgender and intersex athletes from competing in women's events.
People united can never be divided. Come on, our people
united can never be.
A few days later, on March 28th, millions marched worldwide for No King's Day, a demonstration opposing Trump's authoritarian policies. Minnesota Democratic Attorney General Keith Ellison described the federal complaint as a sad attempt to get attention over something that's already been in litigation for months. You see, the state of Minnesota actually filed its lawsuit first, nearly a year ago. In a video released on April 2nd, Ellison reflected on the protest, encouraging people to stay civically engaged.
We showed that people will get up out of their comfort zone and will exercise their First Amendment rights to say no to Trumpism. That is tremendous.
While the ongoing lawsuits continue to pile up, it seems the mood across the country and what's coming out of Washington don't match. A survey funded by the Human Rights Campaign Foundation reveals that over 80% of U.S. adults believe that transgender people should have the same rights and protection as everyone else and should be able to access the health care they need.
Australians in New South Wales are awaiting the imminent release of a report on legal protections against hate crimes. Last year, the government appointed retired Supreme Court Justice John Sacker to lead the initiative after an uptick in hate speech and attacks, particularly targeting queer people. The April 1st deadline to release the Sacker review has come and gone with no report or update about the delay in sight. Legislative Council member John Ruddick delivered a speech imploring the report's release.
Delaying such an important report is not the norm for this parliament, and one must question why. Secrecy breeds suspicion.
Advocates have long warned that delays in responding to the Sacker inquiry risk prolonging a lack of accountability for decades of anti-LGBTQ violence.
Advocacy groups in Kenya are launching a new campaign to get the LGBTQ community registered to vote. Organizations like INED, the Initiative for Equality and Non-Discrimination, and GALC Plus are partnering with Gen Z activists for the Queer the Ballot movement. The groups say that despite facing homophobia, violence, and legal barriers in daily life, queer Kenyans should use the ballot box to demand leaders who respect their rights. Non-binary activist Bubois Merrilies expressed how important visibility is in changing discriminatory laws.
We need systems that actually allow queer people to be able to show up in whatever way and still be able to exist.
The general election is a year away. However, next month, Kenya's Court of Appeal will hear a case challenging the criminalization of consensual same-sex relationships in the nation's penal code.
Finally, congratulations are in order for a team of transgender athletes celebrating a major win at one of the toughest races in the world. Champion trans swimmer Skylar Baylor, deaf non-binary cyclist Chella Mann, and trans non-binary marathoner Cal Kalamia won third place in the Oceanside, California Ironman, competing as Team Iron Mask. An Ironman is an extreme endurance race combining swimming, cycling, and running, often covering more than 70 miles in a single event. Kalamia told Out Magazine, "We're just excited to keep inspiring people and providing a counterweight to the other conversations about trans athletes."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending April 3rd, 2026. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Ebony Joseph and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm John Dyer V. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
This Way Out's Greg Gordon passed away on March 5th. This week and next, we pay tribute to his contributions to queer history.
I'm Harvey Milk. I'm a supervisor in San Francisco.
And I'm Greg Gordon for IMRU.
I'm gay.
And so am I.
It may not seem like much now, but when This Way Out's founding coordinating producer Greg Gordon said it alongside Harvey Milk in 1979, it was still a big deal. It certainly was not the first time Greg had declared himself on the airwaves. He told IMRU's Michael Taylor Gray,
"I had come out in the late 60s, early 70s. In 1974, I was doing volunteer work at what was then called the Gay Community Services Center, and it was located in downtown L.A. This was, you know, the early 70s, so it was the age of workshops and rap groups and consciousness raising. And someone from KPFK posted a notice. At the time, there was a once-a-month lesbian show and a once-a-month gay men show. And the guy that was doing the gay men show was moving, and so KPFK needed some other new people. And yours truly and two other guys signed up, and we did our first show in August of 1974 on KPFK. And it was a live with phone-in show.
The old left bedrocks had not yet become today's ally-filled progressive movement. So even on public radio, the work was challenging.
We used to get abusive phone calls when we opened the phones, as well as, I know, good calls and question calls and all that, but really vile stuff.
Some 5 years later, Greg was on his way to San Francisco to interview recently elected Supervisor Harvey Milk.
Harvey has graciously taken a few minutes out of his very busy schedule to talk to us about politics in San Francisco and how he got elected, the first openly gay person to be elected to public office in California history.
I'd like to also talk about the politics in California rather than San Francisco.
That's fine.
Because I don't think there's a delineation.
You don't think that there's a difference in politics in San Francisco as opposed to, let's say, politics in Los Angeles?
It's a matter of degree. There's no moat built around the city of San Francisco that separates us from the rest. Sometimes we wish there were. but I think what takes place in San Francisco, for whatever reasons, can take place any place. It's just a matter of understanding what it's all about.
It was a wonderful interview. We did it in the back of his camera shop on Castro Street, sort of the base of his political operations. So throughout the interview, every now and then you hear a little ding, ding, ding with the camera shop door opening and closing. But he was just as warm and charming and personable as you can imagine. And, of course, an incredibly articulate advocate for queer causes and recognizing the importance of what we now call intersectionality. I mean, he got to the unions, he spoke with all the different racial and ethnic minorities, you know, so he realized that in coalition, progressive people could win.
I also reminisced with Greg about Harvey Milk.
I will always remember Greg. You and I were working for a gay and lesbian newspaper.
Coast to Coast Times. Yes.
And I remember we were busily putting the newspaper together, and you walked into my office with this ashen look on your face and just said with this complete incredulity, "I just heard on the radio that Harvey's been shot." And how did you feel at that moment? Do you remember?
Shock. And I remember that everything in the entire office just stopped, and we turned the radio up and we listened. We have to remember the context of this, too. This was like 2 or 3 weeks after our successful victory over John Briggs and the Briggs Initiative, which would have banned gay and lesbian teachers in California's public schools, or even a janitor who happened to say he thought gay people should get equal rights. He could have been fired under this measure. And so, I mean, it was such, you know, coming off of that high, which we were still experiencing, and then to have Harvey get shot, I mean, so shocking.
As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed. The suspect is Supervisor Dan
White. Has been found guilty of one count each of voluntary manslaughter.
Police have arrived at City Hall. They've got riot squad gear on. The police are pushing people off the steps.
Nowhere was Greg's skill as a producer and audio editor more evident than in the documentary Diminished Capacity. His prowess with a razor blade, yes, razor blades and quarter-inch tape, was remarkable. Here's an excerpt from that documentary on the aftermath of the assassinations of Harvey Milk and George Moscone.
I remember that week when the tapes that we got from KPFA's coverage came down to us, and I started to listen to them, and my jaw just dropped open, because the people from the
Fruit Punch,
were on the scene, and in some of the cases, some of them were probably getting beaten by police as they were trying to report on what was going on. It's just riveting, riveting sound.
What do you think of what's going on right now, sir?
I think they should burn down the whole place. City Hall doesn't represent us. The city government isn't representing us.
Something has run amok. It's real sad when somebody who murders, that legalized assassination, I don't like to see.
Well, I'm just here because I feel like I had to register my feelings some way. Although I'm not gay or anything, I just said he should have gotten so many more than 5 years.
The grating in front of City Hall continues to get torn down. Police have arrived at City Hall, at the doors of City Hall. They've got riot squad gear on. There's pushing and shoving going on. The police are pushing people off the steps. It has now broken loose. Cops are now bashing heads of the people, of indeed the people who had formed a human chain, who to protect City Hall are now getting bashed by police. The people who had been protecting City Hall are now getting dragged away by police. The police are now moving out into the crowd. Moving out into the crowd and just flailing about.
Running back. The police have literally beaten the crowd.
Gay people are carrying gay people away who have been hurt and hit. The police moved into a group of people who were sitting down and not moving. And just clubbed away. And they realized that obviously our nonviolent not moving was not going to work. Gay people proceeded to run. And now pretty much there's a 15-foot distance between us and the line of police who are coming down. You can hear their voices. And here they are.
Well, I'm 6 foot nothing of muscle and bone. With my Colt 45, I weigh 17 stone. Got Stetson hat and a big cigar. And I clean up trouble with my little tin star.
I'm a little tired of the weary throwaway line that there is no such thing as the gay sensibility. Of course there is such a thing as the gay sensibility. Of course gay men and women think in some fundamental ways differently from straights. It is not just about what we do in bed. It is about the echoes in the culture of who we are or who we aren't. Hi, I'm Clive Barker. Listen to This Way Out.
The community heard Harvey's call.
I called for that march on the day of freedom in Washington, D.C., on the same spot where over a decade ago, Dr. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream that is fading, a dream that is becoming a nightmare. We will be here.
And Greg heard a call to ride the freedom train to Washington, D.C.
Holla, bro.
Amtrak Freedom Train as it left the Oakland, California terminal, carrying some 75 lesbians and gay men to Sunday's National March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights.
The journey on the train has superseded my expectations many times over. I really am enjoying the sense of community, as short-lived a community as it will be, just, you know, less than a week.
I can't say the word. I don't know the word to say. It's been wonderful.
What's your name?
Dennis.
How long have you been working the railroad, Dennis?
Oh, about 30 years.
This is going to be a trip you're going to remember.
Oh, I'll remember this trip for real. I never will forget this trip.
I like the political interaction between the men and women. I'm real impressed with that. I'm seeing more and more of it, and I'm real involved in politics, and it's nice to be able to talk to men about politics.
Only thing I can say, I haven't slept much on this whole trip. I think we're probably all excited enough to where it is not bothering us that we haven't slept for 2 days now.
I appreciate the fact that we're not alone on this train, as we are not alone in the rest of the world. We have to talk to these people, and that's why we're going to Washington.
Jesse, is there anything you can compare this crowd to in your experience on the train?
A lovely, lovely crowd. I had some nice crowds, but this is the most loveliest crowd I've had.
How long have you been working on the railroad?
31 years. Still, people got nothing but compliments from all other people. Looks like you made that trip more happy. The eyes are open more now, I guess.
There's an old line communist on the train, and there's a Bircher who thinks the metric system is a communist conspiracy. We've had a chance to talk to all of those people, and that's what it was all about.
It was like one big family, and I didn't expect that. Because I'm not out that much, I didn't know what to expect, really. But it's like everybody knows each other, and it's a great feeling. I love it.
We are going, heaven knows where we are going. We'll know we're there.
Lincoln, Nebraska, 2:45 a.m. Friday, October 12th.
I don't believe it.
What are you people doing up at this hour of the morning?
Come out! Bring everybody out! Oh,
we got a sign. We want you to take this as Lincoln.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It's 3:30 in the morning in Lincoln, Nebraska, for Christ's sake. You realize what's happening here?
It's great to realize that the 60 of us on this train are carrying the spirit of all the places we stopped throughout the nation, because no matter where we've stopped, there has been at least one person coming out. Now tonight, 30 people in Lincoln, Nebraska, coming out at 3:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, to support us and give us their flag.